Hey, welcome back to another episode of the Heal Utah Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pacenza, Heal's Executive Director. Thanks for listening. Every week, we take a look at all things green in Utah, environmental issues, controversies, and the people at the heart of them. Good afternoon. We are delighted today to be joined by a very well-known author, environmentalist, Derek Jensen. Derek, thank you so much for being on the Heal Utah podcast today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Derek is the author of many books and a super important and influential and well-known figure in the environmental community. We're going to talk to him today about a few different things, and one of them is his newest book entitled The Myth of Human Supremacy. So folks should certainly check that book out. Another thing I wanted to ask you about today, Derek, is a letter. And you'll have to give me the context of how this letter came to be, but it's entitled An Open Letter to Reclaim Environmentalism. And folks can go ahead and read that on your website, which is derekjensen.org. That's DERRICK Jensen.org. So people should go read that. It's a provocative work. Derek, we're just going to start out with kind of a tough and challenging question here, that you're someone that definitely has some serious questions and some serious concerns about kind of mainstream environmentalism and kind of environmental groups and what they do. And one of the quotes I pulled out of this letter was that you believe that advocating sustainability, that this word in particular, and I think the key word in there might be sustain, is itself sort of a form of kind of attacking the environment and attacking non-human life and the health of the planet. So tell us a little bit about that. What concerns you so about kind of mainstream environmentalism and what its aims and its projects are?
Well, I came up through the ranks of being a grassroots environmental activist, and what we were doing is trying to save pieces of land from this culture, or stop forests from being cut down, or protecting bull trout or selk or caribou, or, you know, this or that creature or this or that plant. And we were attempting to sustain their lives. And unfortunately, especially mainstream environmentalism has undergone a transformation where it's not really about sustaining the real world, but instead it's become about sustaining this way of life. And their primary loyalty is not to the land, but instead it's to sustaining industrial culture, which industrial culture is what's killing the planet. And so that's a huge, you know, in many ways, it's in the United States at least, it goes back to the split between John Muir, who was trying to protect wild places for their own sake, and Gifford Pinchot, who was trying to protect natural resources to use them to sustain this way of life. And so that's my fundamental point of that is that environmentalism is really supposed to be about not trying to sustain this culture, but instead to help the natural world to survive this culture.
And let's now turn, Derek, to your newest book. And again, that's The Myth of Human Supremacy. And obviously in a book-length work, you have an opportunity to develop these ideas much more fully. And where this book works so well, I think, is both in its ways in which it shows that, so much of the ideas that drive modern life, just assume within them that humanity's needs and everything about humanity is primary and is superior to any other non-human life, whether that's, you know, animals or anything else. And then the other thing you do in the book so well, of course, is to show the complexity and the intricacy and the intelligence of non-human life forms. The idea of human supremacy, why is it so harmful, and how does it drive so many of these ills that you write about so eloquently?
Well, thank you for the kind way you put the question. And I'd like to answer the second question first. And maybe 25 years ago, I read one line in a book that I don't remember the rest of the book, but this line just really blew me away, which is, unquestioned beliefs are the real authorities of any culture. And that has just resonated with me very, very strongly. And so much of what we do is, well, I'm going to back up a second. How we perceive the world affects how we behave in the world. And what we believe about the world affects how we perceive the world. And if you believe, I mean, we've seen studies on this for a bazillion different ways, that people who don't believe global warming is happening, every new piece of evidence that comes out, no matter what it is, they end up using to show that global warming isn't happening. And I love this line by John Livingston, which is believing is seeing. It's not so much that seeing is believing, it's believing is seeing, that how you perceive the world really affects how you behave in the world. I'm going to back up a second. And there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman. When I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. And if when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. And if when you look at this particular tree, you see this particular tree, you'll treat it differently still. And the same thing is true, for example, with women. This is one of my very strong, of many, many strong objections to pornography, that if when you see a woman, you see orifices, then you're going to treat her one way. And if when you see a woman, you see a woman, you'll treat her differently. When you see this particular woman, you treat her differently still. And this has huge ramifications for how we are in the world. I live on Talowa Indian land, the T-O-L-O-W-A, Talowa. They lived here for at least 12,500 years without destroying the place. And so many indigenous people have said to me that the most fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor as opposed to the way the world really is. They perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. And this is a profound difference that will have profound effects on how we treat the world. There was an article in the local, I live on the coast, and there was an article in the newspaper a couple, 3 years ago about why the crabbers work so hard during their crabbing season. And the newspaper said that each crab at the time was worth about $1.50. And so the newspaper said, imagine that there were all these envelopes all over the ground, each one has $1.50 in it. You would run around as fast as you can picking up envelopes. And that's all fine, except that crabs aren't actually envelopes with $1.50 in them. Crabs are other beings whose lives are just as important to them as yours is to you and mine is to me. And that doesn't mean, by the way, that nobody ever eats anybody, because this whole world is based on feeding others, eating others, and how all this works together. And so really, one of the fundamental points, I'll make 2 points about the book. One of the fundamental points of the book is that life is not like a game of Risk, where the point is to try to conquer everybody else's territory and have as many of your little plastic armies as you can. Life is more like a symphony, where what we are supposed to do is not, you know, go drown the oboe players and take their seats, but instead to figure out our proper role and then to play it. I mean, how do we think that forests got to be so wild and fecund and full of life? And how do we think that rivers did? And how do we think that the plains did, and prairies and oceans? They did it by everybody living and dying and contributing, and not by everybody taking down. I mean, you know, I'm known for saying we need to stop civilization from killing the planet, but this is not because I hate hot showers or because I hate Beethoven's Ninth. It's because I know I can do simple math. I recognize that if there used to be 6 billion passenger pigeons and then 5 and then 4, eventually there won't be any, as is the case. And there are, if you weighed all the fish in the oceans in 1870 and then you weighed them again in 2010, they would only weigh 10% as much as they did before. And there are stolid scientists who are saying the oceans could be effectively devoid of fish within the next 40 years. And that's terrifying. And you would think that since we consider ourselves to be so very, very intelligent, that we would be able to recognize this pattern. I'm going to say one more thing, I guess. Two more things still. Sorry.
It's all right.
One of them is that, you know, they say that one sign of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. I'm going to lay out a pattern here, and let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years, which is when you think of Iraq as the first thing that you think of, cedar forests so thick that sunlight never touches the ground. That's how it was before the beginnings of this culture. And one of the first written myths of this culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the hillsides of Iraq to make a great city. And the Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna. And the Near East was heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. The forests of North Africa went down to make the Egyptian and Phoenician navies. Greece was heavily forested. The ancient Greek philosophers, some of them complained about how deforestation was harming water quality. And so if you see this pattern that goes for thousands of years of increasing human technical capacities at the same time that there is this decreasing, that the world's being killed, you can understand that the capacities of this culture come, it's a zero-sum game. It comes with one side gaining and the other side losing, and that can't continue on a finite planet. And once again, I'm not saying this is a human problem, because the Talua lived here for 12,000 years, and they were conquered just as the salmon had been conquered, and the Hoopa were conquered, and the Wiat were conquered, and so it's not that. And then the last thing I want to say about the human supremacism whole thing is that we perceive ourselves as being so very, very intelligent, but there's actually a deeper problem, which is that I'm not in this book merely talking about human supremacism. I'm talking about a way of life that perceives difference as a means of judging superiority and inferiority, as opposed to perceiving difference as difference. That in a community, there's one line, I guess I'll try to say this, the plants communicate, and if one plant is getting chewed on, it will send out messages by pheromones to other plants saying, hey, change the composition of your leaves to make it so this caterpillar does not like to eat you. And there's some scientists ask this question, which gets to the heart of everything, which is they asked, why would one plant waste energy cluing in its competitors that there is an insect eating it? And that question is everything that's wrong with this culture, because the reason that the plants will clue in their, quote, competitors is because they're not. Imagine if instead they use the word neighbors instead of competitors. And the reason that a plant will clue in the other plants is because the plant is smart enough to recognize that a redwood forest consists of more than just alder plants. It also consists of cascara. It consists of cedar trees. It consists of redwood trees. It consists of dragonflies. It consists of all these other beings who have to work together to actually make a forest what it is. It's kind of like what if your pancreas suddenly decided that it's the only organ that matters in your entire body. And so your pancreas says, hey, you got two kidneys. You don't need both of those. You got two lungs. Let's get that. You got too much gray matter up there. So you don't need that. So let's put some pancreas matter up there and push it out. And, why do you need so much intestine? And then the pancreas starts taking over the whole body. I mean, it would obviously kill the entire body. And that's what we see happening. And what I'm suggesting with this book is that the way the real world really works is more like a body, where everyone has their own function. The pancreas does its thing, the spleen does its thing, the stomach does its thing, and they all work together to make something that is bigger than everything individually.
If you're enjoying this week's show, I'd love to ask you a favor, and that is to please consider subscribing to the podcast. You can do that easily in a few ways. One is simply go to iTunes and search for Heal Utah. The other is to go to our website, healutah.org. Click on Current News and then Podcast, and you'll find easy instructions on how to subscribe. Thanks again for listening and for being a part of Heal Utah.
We're joined today by Derek Jensen, author of his new book, The Myth of Human Supremacy. And Derek's certainly well known as an environmentalist and an activist, and probably, I suspect, Derek best known for Endgame. That feels to me like the book that probably most folks cross their radar. Let's dig a little deeper. There's a part early in the book where you put out the definition of what it means to be a sociopath and about lacking empathy. And then talk about how, you know, and just innumerable examples throughout the book about ways in which, you know, modern civilization sort of lacks anything close to empathy for non-human life. And I guess the thought it drove for me is that it is wondering about, is it fair to see the ways in which humanity kind of looks out for each other and sort of, you know, the bond between a mother and a child and people's concern, you know, primarily being for, you know, children everywhere or other people. Is it fair to kind of see that as a pathology? Isn't there something inherent, even biological, about sort of, you know, looking out for one's own? And, or is that, you would see that more as sort of culturally driven and sort of, being something that is been, you know, kind of driven into modernity as opposed to being sort of, you know, at the heart of us.
Oh, no, I don't have a problem I care more about my mother than I do you. I mean, nothing personal, of course, which is the point, you know, and I'm sure that, you know, you have a picture there with a child. Is that your son?
Yeah, I have two sons.
Yeah, okay, so I presume that you care more about your sons than you do about me.
Fair statement, Derek, for sure.
Yeah. So I don't have a problem with that. My problem is that when we come to perceive these others as inferior and as exploitable as resources. So I'm not suggesting that you need to like me as much as you do your sons. What I'm suggesting is that if you perceive me, because I am not your sons, as inferior and exploitable, I think that becomes problematical. Do you see what I'm trying to get at? And if not, I'll try again.
No, absolutely. I think that's well explained.
Yeah, and I think, you know, honestly, I don't have a problem with somebody liking other humans better than they like mosquitoes. The problem I have, and I mentioned this in the book, is that there are those who say that mosquitoes need to be eradicated entirely. And I think that is a dreadful idea for any number of reasons, one of which is we have no idea what role mosquitoes play in their larger communities. I mean, if mosquitoes, say mosquitoes were, you could snap your finger and make all mosquitoes go away, what would happen to those who primarily eat mosquitoes? What would happen to, I know male mosquitoes don't eat blood. I don't know. Do they pollinate at all? So I don't know. So the point is that it's not that we care about humans more than gophers, mosquitoes, lions. I don't know. The point is that presuming that these others don't have a very important role to play in their natural communities. That's my point.
I want to ask you, Derek, about if you think there's any role for any kind of optimism or any kind of hopefulness. And I think that, you know, those of us who work professionally in the environmental movement obviously have a vested interest, there's no doubt about it, in seeing the world as sort of, you know, at least there being some steps forward and some encouraging developments. And, you know, whether we find that from, you know, the widespread use of solar power, or whether we find it from, you know, facts, the ways in which kind of environmental regulation within the United States, at least, has actually done a lot of good. And I think there's, you know, a really good example would be lakes and rivers and the Clean Water Act. And I'm from upstate New York, and the Hudson River, you know, 50 years ago was kind of a body of water that was truly, you know, sort of mostly devoid of life, and you couldn't go anywhere near it. And now 40, 50 years later, you know, it's cleaned up a lot, and it's a body of water that's returned in many ways much closer to its natural state. So does any of that give you any hope that this isn't just a trajectory that's sort of, you know, going from pristine to, you know, a rock careening through the heavens with nothing on it? Is there any possibility that humans can right this ship?
Well, there's a couple, it seems there's a couple questions inherent in that. And one of the questions I want to address is that I don't have a problem with attempting to work within the system. I'm not a purist. I actually don't care why dams on the Klamath come down, whether it's because of an agreement between the various Indian nations and the power company and the states involved. That's great. You know, the dams on the Klamath are going to come down. I don't care if it's because of that or because of an earthquake. You know, it's like what's important to me is that the dams come down. And well, actually, that's not what's even important to me. What's important to me is that the salmon recover. And so once again, I don't have a problem with the Clean Water Act. I don't believe in the revolution versus reform dichotomy. I believe that if we all wait for the great glorious revolution, then there's not going to be anything left. And on the other hand, if all we do is reform work, this culture is going to grind away until there's nothing left. And so I want to be really clear that I am really pragmatic in terms of whatever works, I'm all for. And whatever makes things better for the real physical world, I'm all for. I love the Wilderness Act. You know, it's a great thing. It's not enough, but it's a great thing. So that's one thing. And so far as optimism, you know, honestly, the optimism I do have, which isn't a lot, comes from the fact that life itself wants to live. And it doesn't come from, and it comes from the fact that there are more than 450 dead zones in the ocean, and there is one that has recovered. And the one dead zone that has recovered is in the Black Sea. And it recovered because the Soviet Union collapsed. And with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the economic...
They stopped discharging stuff into the water, I assume.
Yeah, exactly. Industrial agriculture was no longer feasible in the region. And it only took 25 years for it to recover. I want to be clear that I'm not saying that, oh, life is so resilient that no matter what we throw at it, everything's going to be okay. I'm not saying that at all. But what I am saying is that Here's the image that I always have for environmentalists. And I want to be also really clear that anybody who is trying to protect land or trying to protect rivers or trying to protect species is a hero. And I am not disparaging the work of anybody who's doing that. But here's the image that comes to mind is that so many of us doing all this work, it's like there's a body that came into the emergency room and it's bleeding out. And there's all these doctors and nurses who are just putting on bandages and sewing up wounds as quickly as they can. And they're all working like crazy. And it's really important work. But at the same time, they're not doing the most important thing of all, which is there is still the murderer is still hacking away with a knife at the body. And it seems to me that as well as doing all this recovery work, we also need to stop the person who is stabbing. And that's the larger culture, you know. It's like I was talking to somebody a couple of days ago about how the state of the oceans, which is just dreadful. And I mean, I was saying that I wish that they would use the navies around the world to stop the illegal fishing, at least. That would be something in the right direction. And one of the things he works on quite a lot is the Navy exercises in the North Pacific, which have just recently been given permission by National Marine Fisheries Services to kill or injure 12 million marine mammals in the North Pacific. The thing is, that's actually more marine mammals than there are in the North Pacific. So they've been given permission to kill all of them if that's what they want. So the point is that we have this larger superstructure, which is really harming everything, and we are doing what we can within it, and that's wonderfully important, but there needs to be more. That's my point.
Thank you, Derek. We'll just ask one final question here. I wish we had a lot more time. We're joined again today by Derek Jensen, and provocative and smart and interesting and thought-provoking. So more time would be great, but we just unfortunately can only do one more question. You know, I want to ask you, I think there's always an inherent contradiction when, you know, you're a deep critic of something, but also obviously a part of it. And, you know, you've been fortunate, you know, due to the power of your ideas and hard work, I'm sure, to build a career as a writer and to be able to kind of put all these great thoughts out there via the modern world, via, you know, the infrastructure we've built to deliver culture and ideas to people, whether it be through this crazy fancy internet thing that we're talking over now, or of course, just the good old fashioned book and how that gets moved around. So how do you reconcile that? I think some people read you and they think that you want us to go back to, you know, some pre-human moment when people are huddled around a fire and none of the beauty of where we are now is there. So do you feel obliged to kind of reconcile that, or is that just an inherent contradiction that we have to kind of live with?
Well, there's a line that a friend of mine, Lear Keith, always says that I really love, which is the task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive authority with as much personal integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to take down those systems of oppressive authority. And so I don't actually have a problem with using the tools of the system to attempt to stop it from doing its harm. You know, we're facing off against, you know, those in power have the real power of the internet. They've got the power of the media. They've got the power of tanks, guns, and airplanes. And I'm not going to try to resist them. I'm going to try to resist them using any tools necessary.
Fair enough. I really appreciate your time today. I would urge everyone to go to Derek's website. That is derekjensen.org, and Derek is spelled D-E-R-R-I-C-K, Jensen with an E.org. And on there, Derek, I'd urge folks to go ahead and take a look at, if they kind of scroll down to the right side, there's this open letter to reclaim environmentalism. And I think that's a particularly provocative and important thing for listeners of the Heal Utah podcast to listen to. And then certainly check out Derek's new book as well, The Myth of Human Supremacy. Derek, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for being on the Heal Utah podcast.
Well, thank you so much for your great questions.
Thanks very much for listening to this week's Heal Utah podcast. Again, I'm Matt Pacenza, Heal's Executive Director, and we really appreciate you listening to our weekly show about all things green in Utah. We hope you found this week's show interesting and inspiring, and that you'll join HEAL as we fight for clean air, clean energy, and to protect Utah's health and the environment. Learn more at HEALUtah.org or look for us on Facebook and Twitter.